Okay, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. His name is Chuck from Collegeville.
For the record, Acts of Recovery's definition of free food is sloppy joes, and they're really not that good. I'm Chuck. I'm an alcoholic. I say Chuck from Collegeville, but I'd be lying. My last home group was in Philadelphia. I haven't had one since I moved back up to the area, and I politely got harassed for about a half hour 2 weeks ago when I came here because I don't have a home group. This is my home group as of 2 weeks ago. It's really a pleasure to be up here. My sobriety date is August 1st, 2005. I have a sponsor, and he's got a sponsor. And we all kind of merrily went through the 12 steps. And I live a pretty good life. I am an alcoholic. I've had many short and long-lived careers as a heroin addict and a pill popper and, everything else under the sun. But I'm here to talk about my alcoholism. I am an alcoholic, and the bottom line is when I pick up a drink, I can't stop drinking. And I suffer just about every consequence you can suffer at the hands of drinking. I was in my first mental hospital. I was 14 years old. Locked facility, not like, somewhere where you come and go as you please. And I was there again, I think 3 weeks later. I've been in juvenile placements, I've been to county jails, I've been in hospitals and detoxes and everything else under the sun. And this is the first thing that worked for me. Consequences or, the thought of what my drinking is going to bring about will never keep me sober. I have a good family. I have an all right job. I hate it, but it's it pays the bills. I have a son, and all these things are great, but they're not why I stay sober. They're good motivators when it comes to those points in the day or in the week or whatever it may be where, I need to choose A or B. And having these things, these tangible things help me to make, right decisions. But I'm sober here today because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was, beaten up, and I just didn't want to suffer anymore. The jumping off point to me is like second nature. Not wanting to drink, but not being able to go on without it. Towards the end, before I got sober, there was like enjoyment was gone. All the drink did was solidify how much of a piece of shit I already was. I was aware of it before I put it in me. I was 10 times more aware of it when I put it in me, and I was 10 times more aware of it so after I, when I needed it again. I come from a normal family, but alcohol tore my household apart. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. I come from a long line of, I think my mother's whole side of the family is like mental illness is prevalent, and my father's whole side of the family, drug addiction and alcoholism is prevalent, I'm sorry. And if they don't use drugs, they deal them. I don't know if any of that's why I'm an alcoholic. I don't know if I was born with this, or I don't know about the isms and all this stuff people talk about that's not written in the big book. I don't know if, did I do stuff that most first graders didn't do? Probably. I was laying on the phone with somebody the other day. There was an Asian kid that I went to school with, and I guess his parents didn't buy him cool toys, and I used to sell him my toys. I don't know what I did with the money, but I used to sell G.I. Joes and stuff. And I don't know if that's normal. I don't know if that makes me an alcoholic or an entrepreneur, but I know it's not normal. I know firsthand what alcohol does to families and relationships and households and so on and so forth. I took my first drink when I was 11. That I can recollect. The older people did it, so it was normal to like snag a can of Coors Extra Gold from the refrigerator and drink it and like act cool with your friends or whatever. I was 11 years old and I started to drink, and I don't know if I was an alcoholic prior to that date. I know an alcoholic was born that day, and I didn't stop drinking, for every bit of 10 years, and I don't know. I never drank without consequence. Like these pictures that the big book paints of the alcoholic, we would get, everybody would throw money and get a box of you know, bottles of Menthol 2020 or, you know, we drank Colt 45 and stuff like that. And, you know, when the beer would run out, the booze and the wine would run out, everybody else would go home. I drink till either full, whether here or there against the wall just walking, or I drink till I fall asleep. When everybody else is walking home or stumbling home, I'm climbing in people's back windows and sheds and garages, you know, stealing gallons of wine and stuff like that. And I drink till I can't, you know, I can't stop drinking, and I drink till I can't drink anymore at all. You know, I suffer from what the Big Book describes as a phenomenon of craving. Like, alcohol makes you feel good. I don't, if you, unless you're like inhumane or inhuman. You take a drink, it loosens you up, you start to groove, you know. My sister enjoys it. She takes a drink. Logical reasoning sets in. I have children, I have a decent job, I have a driver's license, you know, whatever it may be. And she, you know, likely makes the right decision. Maybe I'll stop. Like, two drinks is a lot for her. I take one drink, and before I'm through the first one, I'm already worried about the second one. And by like the third or fourth, I'm on Front Street speaking Spanish. Like, you know what I mean? That's my experience. And I don't know if I have, like, I don't know if we dropped the pen. I don't know if that has anything to do with the phenomenon of craving, but that's my experience. Like, a night of drinking's gone. You know, four or five beers, and I'm stealing your car or taking mine, and I'm down the way. And selling all my worldly possessions and gladly trading everything I've worked for in whatever small period of sobriety I've acquired at this point in my life, and you know, sacrificing it all for what seems to be, you know, the ease and comfort that's supposed to come from this first drink, but it's gone. And that's what I spent a good 10 years doing. And people are like, oh, you're young, and you got something. I've been everywhere. I've been homeless. I've been hit with baseball bats, run over with cars, hospitalized, institutionalized. You know, I was on every medication under the sun, psych meds and, like, ADHD medications and all this stuff before I was 16. And they didn't even, like, experimental drugs then they were giving me. And, and I was leaving out when I would go sit with these shrinks, the fact that I'm drinking like gallons of wine, smoking all kind of pot and all this stuff. And so I'm taking Prozac, and instead of it being an antidepressant, now it's, I'm making me psychotic. And, you know, I can remember the one night being, I don't like when the cops try to arrest me. I'm a pretty big kid. I've been this big since like the sixth grade. Like, you're under arrest. No, I'm not. You know what I mean? Like, simple as that. And I borrowed this car one night, and I wasn't supposed to borrow it. And it was an old Buick. And when I came to bring it back, I took the car to cop. You know what I mean? So when I came to bring it back, the police were waiting there because the people were filing a report. And I tried to get away. It was like an 84 Skylark. It went nowhere. You know what I mean? And it's in the neighborhood I grew up in. So I get to the top of the street and jump around. They're like, Neilman. And I'm like, I just keep running. And the bottle slides down my pant leg. And they catch up with me in like 10 feet. You know? I don't think it's far. But, you know, like, I can remember, I think I was 16 then. And, I can remember my mother coming to get me and them saying, you know, Mr. Neilman, if we release you to your mother and your sister, that's who I lived with. And, you know, are you going to hurt anybody or yourself? And I'm like, all slosh in the corner, like crying to myself. I'm like, probably. You know, they're like, they shackle me. They take me to Norristown State Hospital. And I spent a week there. It was quite an experience. But none of this stuff matters. Like, I get out of there. It was a Thursday. Mom's like, you probably shouldn't go out. Mom, phew. Okay, I'm doing what I want. At this point in my life, I did exactly what I wanted to. And that's what I did. And I got arrested again that night. And I got arrested every, like, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. For a whole month, you know what I mean? I fought the cops one night. I stole the car I told you about. One night I was at North Penn High School football game, and I decided that I was going to sell some bootleg substances because I needed some money. And part of Act 64, if anybody's familiar with it, which kind of drug possession, whether felony or misdemeanor, falls under, it don't matter what it is. If it's packaged to look like it, it is it. And they're searching my pockets. They pull all this stuff out. I'm like, don't get a hard on, boys. It's fake. And they're like, it's your lucky night, asshole. You know what I mean? And, you know, and I remember my father picking me up that night. He's like, you got a problem? Of course I got a problem. You know what I mean? I'm on probation. I just got called, you know, felony drug possession because I got, like, normal household crap in my pocket. You know what I mean? That's like the fourth arrest I've had all month. Like, yeah, I got a serious problem. But it's not drinking. It's the legal system. I've been on probation. I've been on probation since I was 12. I couldn't even say it. I ain't been drinking, I promise. I've been on probation since I was like 12 years old. I've done it all, and I'm not, that doesn't make me anything. It's just, you know, crime and booze go hand in hand with me. And I went away to rehab, and there was this woman, and she was like 8 years sober at this point. She was young, and she, you know, she had a way with, you know, younger kids, and you know, she told me, I was in there with like all these kids that were like heroin addicts and stuff, and I was just like a drunk, you know, a weed smoker and all at this point. And I was like, I ain't nothing like these kids, man, like, you know, nothing. And it's kind of crazy, like I ended up becoming everything these people were, and everything everybody in my neighborhood that I used to laugh at and say, oh, what a POS, and you know, that junkie mother effer and all that stuff, like I became all of that. And it's kind of crazy, like I crossed paths with this woman like years later. She's like, she's a really good friend of mine, this woman that was like the juvenile counselor. And it was actually Miramont. I don't even know when it was, but I had this cool experience the second time I was in Miramont. There was this kid named Mike, and he's my roommate. And you know, we got in there and we talked about what people in detox talked about, Mutter Street, 17th and Jefferson, you know what I mean, Black Tape, you know, stuff like that. And you know, he said to me the one night, he said, you know, why don't we try talking about something positive, you know? And this was a guy that at some point in the past had an experience with Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps. And I can remember, it was Christmas Eve, and like he told me his story, and he like got beat up really bad when he was young, and you know, got a lot of money, and you know, consequently blew the money, and had a pretty tough road, you know, and ended up with absolutely nothing. And you know, he was in this place, and he shared this story for like a half hour about, you know, who he was. And you know, and he started to, like, he took this notebook out, and he started to kind of, like, you know, break down the 12 steps, we'll say. And I didn't choose to, like, embrace this way of life at that point. But I can tell you something, like, I remember, it was late, too, and there was snow on the ground. And, you know, I can remember going outside, like, the counselor let us sneak out to smoke a cigarette. And I felt something that night. And, like, I know I felt hope now looking back, like, in hindsight. Like, I felt some hope for what had been kicking my ass now for the better part of my teenage life. And, you know, I'm the kid that comes around drunk and like you got to go, man. You're not coming in here. You know what I mean? Like, nah. Like, growing up, like, they're like, you can't invite him around a party, or he's not drinking in my house. You know, and, you know, later on, like, I was still this person. And I'm sitting in this detox talking to this kid, and I don't know, like, something happened inside, and I always forget to talk about that when I'm up at the podium. I have so many experiences that, like, I overlook. The funny thing is, I was talking to a friend of mine earlier, and I won the essay contest for the DARE program in the fifth grade. Like, I stood like I'm standing today and read my essay. I swear on my eyes. I got, like, a duffel bag and a t-shirt and a bumper sticker, and, you know what I mean? Like, I couldn't resist drugs and alcohol, though. And it's just kind of funny, and, anyway. So I'm in Miramont, I meet this guy, whatever, he shows me the 12 steps, whatever. I continue to drink. This second time I was in Miramont, I was only there for, like, 10 days, 14 days. And they were like, you know, due to funding, we can either send you home or we can offer you, like, some more treatment. And I said, I'll take, you know, what the option is. And they sent me to White Deer Run in Williamsport, and that sucked horribly. I spent almost every day of that stay in Williamsport, which is stuff between two mountains. I wanted to kill myself every single day I was in that place. And I never really contemplated suicide up to this point in my life. And, you know, this, like, further, you know, reiterates the fact that, like, I'm an alcoholic, and on top of the fact that I suffer from this phenomenon of craving, you know, I suffer from what's known as, like, a spiritual malady, and I don't really know how to describe it in words, except for, like, a disconnection of whatever I believe today to be God, and, you know, a disconnection from these ideas that my God embodies, and, you know, the principles with which this God would live along. You know, my perception of reality, the workings of the world, my role in the world, and everybody else's role in my world were so distorted that I probably could have passed the test for someone mentally ill at this point in my life. And that's another thing that makes me an alcoholic. You know, this disease on top of the spiritual malady, and then, you know, the physical aspect, that's what makes me an alcoholic. You know, and I can't speak for anybody else. You know, like, I have views on, you know, the people that fill the rooms of AA. I don't know. I can only say that I know that I'm an alcoholic. And it's really, like, an admission that's only able to be made within yourself. Like, I hear so many practices of people, like, writing and all when they go through the steps. And, you know, like, when I came here, there was no question that I had a problem, a serious problem. And there was no question that my life was unmanageable. I'm going to fast forward. I've done it all. You know what I mean? I was arrested in 2004 for a robbery because I needed some money to keep drinking. And it was really a drug deal going bad. You know what I mean? And the people had the audacity to call the cops. But that's my luck. You know what I mean? Like, I went to jail in 2004 for robbing a drug dealer. And, you know, no wonder I'm here, right? And I would love to tell you that I spent this, you know, a little bit. I'm not like a hard time or anything. I'm not trying to, like, portray that. You know, I've never spent any more than, like, 9 months in a county jail. But I'm in this jail, and, you know, when the gate slams shut, it's like a unique feeling. It's like similar to the feeling if you've ever been homeless before and had no option and no one to call, and you kind of look both ways and you realize, you know, the pickle you're in. And it's like the most bottomless feeling. Like, I can only use curse words to describe it. You know what I mean? But, like, it's like the most bottomless feeling I've ever felt in my life. And that's what it felt like when the gate shut. And I was like, damn, here we are again. And like, I can remember taking my, like, I flopped up on shore at my dad's house. I'm, you gotta take me to turn myself in, you know what I mean? All right. So I put on, like, an outfit, like, they're gonna let me go, you know what I mean? I'm on probation in one county, I committed the crime in another, like, I know they're giving me a detainer. I've been doing this for, you know, 8-9 years already, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going home. You know what I mean? Besides, like, a miracle or a computer glitch, when they usually only happen on the weekends when you get arrested. They don't happen on Fridays. So I got, like, an outfit on and all. And I can remember riding to this place to turn myself in and with my stepmother. And I couldn't stop crying. I had a whole box of tissues. Like, and the only thing I could say was, like, I can't keep living like this. Like, I can't do it anymore. And I would love to tell you that I went to jail, completed my sentence, never drank again. That'd be a lie. They gave me the work release program. By the time I got back to Montgomery County, I did a little tour. When I was there, I was already sentenced. Everything was already taken care of, so they gave me the work release program. And I did what any good alcoholic would do on the work release program. I knew I couldn't, you know, do what I really like to do because they give you drug tests. But I could drink. I had like a second/third shift job at TGI Fridays in Montgomeryville. I had it all hooked up. You know what I mean? I had all the travel time in the world. I could come back at like 3 a.m. when the third shift guys could care less. And I found myself in the deli on Main Street in Norristown, where every single solitary CO probably drives past on their way to work. I'm in there drinking cans of Busch. You know what I mean? I started out with Heineken 22s, and then I was drinking. And they had the Sparks energy drinks then. But by like an hour into it, I'm just buying 16-ounce cans of beer. And I'm like, I know that feeling, like I'm walking back to get on the bus and it calls again. I get to the bottom of one, I gotta go get another one. I'll get the next bus. By the time I get to work, I'm cross-eyed. I smell like a brewery. They're like, yeah, I'm putting on my apron. They're like, we got somebody to cover your shift, dude. Like, don't even pick up a knife. And, you know, like, that's the best idea I can come up with as an alcoholic in the work release program is to get drunk at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know what I mean? After being in jail for, like, 7 months, you know? And my ideas are, like, they're like cancer to me. And, you know, but I never got caught. I got out of jail, and I ended up in 12 Steps Ahead in Frankfurt. Anybody familiar with 12 Steps? There's got to be somebody that's been to 12 Steps, a resident. Now, it is a hellhole of a recovery house. If I hear one person at the end of this meeting bitch about their recovery house, I'm going to punch you in your face. Okay? Okay, straight up. I'm going to explain this picture for you. It's a block from, like, Tarsdale and Orthodox. It's not the nicest neighborhood. There's a lot worse ones in Philadelphia, but it's definitely not nice. And it's two row homes joined, and there's, like, 32 bodies in it, okay? There's a minimum of, like, 3 beds per room, except for there's a couple in the front that not even Satan himself could put 4 people in these rooms. So there's only 2. And they're homemade wooden bunk beds that are made out of these same, like, kind of 2x4s. When you roll, they squeak so bad that if you got an ornery bunkie, you guys are probably going to fight before 2 a.m. And I roll. I don't sleep still. And I, you know, like... And I walk into this place. It's dirty. There's holes in the floor. The second floor smells like urine. Bad. Like, piss. I couldn't even say urine's like an understatement as to what this place smells like. It smells like piss. And nothing works right. You got to like a maximum of like 5 minutes in the shower before the water's freezing cold. Then you got 32 alcoholic and drug addicted white, black, candy stripe personalities under one roof. And for the most part, it was a pretty fun experience. It was better than the day room. But like my first idea walking into this place is I walk in the front door, I walk out to what is considered a backyard in Frankfurt, and I look out towards the corner. I dropped the pen again. I look out towards the corner, and I think, man, if I could stay sober, I could probably really make some money selling crack around here. I'm dead serious. That was my first thought. Like, that was my plan. I had a job. My brother-in-law owns a roofing business, like a couple miles from here. I had a job making $15 an hour cash cleaning up trash. You know, all I had to do was get on the train in the morning, ride it to Ambler, you know, work, get back on it. They paid me cash at the end of the week. I had one bill was minutes for my Boost mobile phone. You know what I mean? Yeah, I had one of them. And like, my best idea is to sell crack, you know? And so I live in this recovery house with these guys, and it was an experience, to say the least. And I started doing 10 meetings at the Northeast Club on Frankfurt Avenue. Anybody been there? Raise it. Can we get a hand? Can we get a witness? It is the most smoke-infested. It's worse than bars, okay? And to be perfectly honest with you, like, it's not always the message carried there is, you know, one of depth and weight. You know, it's like 70% mandated recovery house residents, and you know, it stinks too. You know what I mean? You can't breathe in there about 10 minutes into the meeting. My choice was either there, AA meetings there, or NA meetings at Whitehall Rec Center. And I don't know why I chose Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did. I was convinced I was a crackhead to this point, but I came to AA, you know. You know, I met up with this guy when I like moved into the recovery house, and I met up with the kind of people that my ideas, you know, afford me. And his name was Good Brother Raheem. From Monday to Thursday, he was a devout Muslim. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, he was a drunk, a thief, a stick-up kid, and a pill popper. And I mean, he drank Hennessy in the room. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, bad. You know, like, it's the kind of person you're like, why are you here? Why don't you go rent a room? It's probably cheaper. I mean, this place is $100 a week. I mean, it's not even cheap. You know, you can rent a room in Kensington for a lot less than that. And you know, but we got along good, and we did what, you know, guys with good ideas in 2 months. Well, I had 2 months sober. I don't think he had a day. But he was Muslim, and so was the house, man. So, you know, it's the way it goes. And I didn't care. Like, I wasn't here to, like, set the world on fire. If Sam's going to ruin his 33-year-old life, then Sam's going to do Sam. I'm sick of going to jail. And I'm sick of sleeping on sidewalks and sneaking into apartment buildings to have somewhere warm to sleep. Me and Sam have a good idea on a Friday night. Me and Sam go out, you know, doing some work. And I almost got killed that night. And I don't know how I made it back to the recovery house without either ending up dead or in jail. And, you know, I got on my knees and I said, man, God, you got to plug me in with these people. Like, these people from these meetings. Because I'm not the one making myself vulnerable, saying, I'm stuck, I want some help. Like, I can be beaten to the point where there's nothing left at all, and I'm not making myself vulnerable. Because my whole life, I make myself vulnerable, I get harmed. So it's not, I'm not the guy, like, it's just not, that was what was instilled in me. Like, I'm the one in the back like this. I'm not talking to you, I don't know you. You know what I mean? And that was the way I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came in here because I was mandated in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've sat in so many business meetings and listened to people debate over whether their meeting should be mandated by Fresh Start or Miracles in Progress or whatever it may be. And I don't know if I would be alive today, you know, if I wasn't made to go to Alcoholics Anonymous by this program. You know, God's everywhere. You know, like, I believe, you know, it was his hand that made me go there. It wasn't some, like, coincidence. And, I don't know, I went there because I was mandated, and I didn't like it at all. It seemed like a good idea. I was, like, the kind of guy who thought he should come in with a notebook and, like, take notes on how to stay sober and stuff. And I didn't know, you know, and, you know, I knew my cousins were, like, an AA and NA when I was young. I had, like, this funny experience. My cousin was, like, a bad, bad heroin addict, like, since I was young. And everyone was always trying to help him. And I remember my dad sitting in the kitchen of the house they lived in. And my cousin's, like, just had a detox or whatever. And my dad's like, yeah, you're going to meetings. He's drinking a can of Busch. And he's like, let me know if you need a sponsor. I'd love to help you. And I'm like, You know, and he didn't know any better. You know what I mean? I guess he thought the sponsor was somebody in your life you call and you feel like going to cop. I don't know. And I'd been to meetings before when I was like 14 or 15. But I'd get my mom to drop me off a block away. I'd smoke a joint on the way in. When you would ask me to read, I'd look at you like, you know, you're ready to take your last breath and you ask me another word. You know, like I was a real nice kid. And I came here because probation said that I had to get a slip sign when I was young. But here I am. And I'm not like, I didn't have any sincere desire. I knew I was sick of living the way I live when I drink. But I had weight on. I had a clean pair of sneaks. If you've ever been in the Northeast Club, that's not, you know, the way a lot of missing teeth, a lot of BO, you know what I mean? Not everybody, but and I'm like, I'm not like these people. You know, a lot of them are coming off Kensington Avenue. They weigh 90 pounds and this, that, and the third and all these. I lost my kids and then I didn't have any of them experiences, you know what I mean? And I'm like, I don't belong here. But I stayed, and I remember walking out of a meeting one night, and I met this kid. He was a kid. I was a kid. He was a kid. And he was smiling. He was smiling like this. And it was real. It wasn't like, I tried to sell you a car smile. It was a real smile. Sorry if there's any car salesmen out here, but I had to. But it runs great. One of those smiles. It wasn't one of those. This kid was happy, and I don't know what it was. Drew you in, and we shook hands. I introduced myself. They introduced himself, and that was that. But I remember, it was like he was running for mayor, you know. And a couple of days later, I'm in the room with this guy. He's my roommate. And we're BS, and he says so and so's in the living room. And I said, I was thinking about asking him to help me. So he's down here. I don't know who put my feet on the floor and rolled me out of that bed and took me down into that living room and asked him if he would help me. I needed a sponsor. I was going to die if I didn't get some help. And he just asked me a few simple questions. Like, I'm sorry, you know, and I'm going to let my experience, like, I was on the phone with my buddy the other day, and the sponsor's got him copying definitions out of the dictionary and all this stuff, and I don't know what's right or wrong, but there's clean-cut directions in the first 164 pages of the big book. Simple and plain. I heard a lot of, you need to read this page and that page and all this stuff, and if you apply what is suggested in this book in your life, it will work. I'm a piece of shit. There's no other way to put it. I will steal your glass eye if you leave it in a jar, and I can get 30 cents. I'm not even trying to be funny. I'll steal anything. I love to steal. I love to stick people up. I love to climb in windows and take other people's cars when I got my own, you know, and I would like spend your money. You know, I'm like Debo, you know what I mean? And I'm by no means like a stand-up guy, like, and here I am, like, I'm AA put honor, you know, in the heart of a piece of shit. And I came here and I followed the directions, and I'm... people, places, and things are irrelevant. I moved to a sober house at Janney and Monmouth. If anybody's familiar, it's like Trenton and Cambria, Tulip and Cambria, right around there. It's not quite the Badlands, but they're only a stone throw away. My neighbor was a drug dealer. They sold drugs all the way up and down Cambria Street, if you didn't already know that. But that was where I got sober. You know what I mean? I was like 4 or 5 months sober living in this house. Like, they're shooting each other in the backyard and all this great stuff. I didn't have another option, you know, and I wasn't allowed to go back to mommy and dad's house, and I had less structure than a recovery house, and I could come and go as I please, and this kid's still showing up now. He's my sponsor, and he's taking me. My first home group was the graduate hospital meeting, young people's it was called. It was a graduate hospital, 20th and South. They knocked down the hospital. I think it might be still a 16th and Locust. Pretty good meeting, actually. Good group of guys and girls. And that was my first home group. And, like, that was the attraction, because, like, Frankfort, Kansas, the ghetto. Like, the meetings, there's nothing nice about it. Like, the meetings are dirty. The people are nuts. Like, you know what I mean? So, like, yeah, we'll go to downtown. There's a good meeting. The girls are hot. Everybody's like, yeah, let's go. And that was how they roped us in, and it was like a pleasure to hop on the L and ride downtown where, like, everything was clean, it was well lit, you know, coffee shops, and, you know, act nuts and have a good time at Alcoholics Anonymous and all. You know, he started to take me through the book, and when I said pray, we prayed, when I said write, we wrote, when I said next, we did what it said next, and I wrote inventory, and I'll share a couple experiences with the 12 steps. I'm not big on doing step studies from the podium. Like, all I'm going to say is, if you're here and you haven't yet had an experience with the 12 steps, you are so selling yourself short. This is not about sitting in AA meetings. If this was about sitting in AA meetings, I would not be sober for 5 years at this point. I would have been gone a long time ago. But I had this experience. I wrote this inventory, and it was tacked on my wall forever. And I used to have this this school bag I used to take on the train. I like to draw. I like to listen to music. So I would take like a Discman. This is before iPods were bigger, before I could afford them. Had a Discman and a notebook and a big book. And I would sit on the train. I would read. I would highlight stuff and all on. The problem is, up until I experienced what the 12 steps have to offer, I couldn't retain information. You know, I was too worried about last month. And I was too worried about when I was going to run into John Doe, whose, you know, ounce I stole, or I was going to run into whoever's, you know, sister I smacked, or something like that. And I was worried about what's going to happen next month, or what about in January, or what about next year, and all this stuff that I'm thinking about yesterday and tomorrow. And I can't sit and read this page and tell you what I just read, and I'm far from a dummy. But I sat down, and this kid gave me clean-cut directions, and I wrote this inventory, and we're at the graduate hospital meeting, and he's like, you got that with you? You got the inventory with you? And I said, no, I left it in my house. I wasn't even lying or trying to swindle him. I really did. And he said, well, we're going to your house. And I was, like, taken beside. It was all right, but I was kind of beside myself. He lived at 19th and Snyder. I lived at Tulip and Cambria. It's, like, far from a stone throw. It's, like, two opposite ends of Philadelphia. And he didn't drive. It was already 10 o'clock. We're at graduate hospital. We got to ride to Kensington, get off the L, walk to my house. He's going to have to walk back and take the night out back, which could be a rough, it'd be a rough bus stop at midnight under the L. You know what I mean? And he wasn't a big kid. He was like a computer geek. You know what I mean? And he did it. And he showed up, and we were there. And it wasn't like, all right, well, we'll sit down at 12. 12 o'clock rolls around. We'll continue this. There was none of that. We're doing this. When we get done, I'll go home, whatever. And I was here a couple weeks ago, and I believe the guy's name was Brian, tall guy. And he talked about, like, you know, anytime he was up till the wee hours of the morning doing God's work, like, God never failed to take care of him. Like, you don't wake up groggy, or, you know, if you waste your latest hour on gas, somehow you manage to get more gas in your car. I don't know how to explain it, but it's always been my experience. And that was what this kid instilled in me, man. You know, like, he had no reason to travel. And it's not even, like, a safe travel. Like, you get killed on the rail for $5. You know what I mean? And, like, for him to wait and take that time out, like, that's what was instilled in me. Not what he said or told me to do, or what he said he did, was what he did and what I watched him do. And there were things like this, and, you know, this promise is written in the big book, and I don't know him verbatim. I'm sure I could pull him out verbatim if I really sat here and thought for a minute, but I'm not going to. I don't ever want to be a book quoter. You know, but, like, I know that I think part of it's, like, you know, we feel at perfect ease with the world around us, and I was able to hold my head up high, and, you know, fear was lifted from me, and that I experienced the next day. I could hold my, like, I wasn't no longer a thief and a scumbag and a piece of shit and a liar and a failure, and, you know what I mean, I was just another human being, you know, trudging this world, trying to, you know, do better with myself, and I continued on, and, you know, we got to the other end of the 12 steps, and he said, it's time for you to start helping people. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And I'm out with this woman. She owns like 90 recovery houses down the way, and we're with this kid, Steve-O, and Steve-O can't stay sober. And she's like, you know, Steve-O needs a sponsor. And I didn't say nothing. You know what I mean? She's like, Chuck, you be a sponsor. I'm about to punch her in her face. I'm like, what? You know what I mean? Like, no. You know, and I let my opinion on what I thought Steve-O should do to stay sober. And he showed up at the Northeast Club on a Sunday night, nodding, and he's like, I took a couple of perks. I'm like, they don't make you nod, you're lying. Ah, I'm grabbing him by his shirt. And, you know, and, you know, that was the first and last time that I entertained the idea that I have anything at all to do with this. There was a kid, Nick, that I lived with in my sober house, we'll call it, and, Nick was a pretty entertaining character. Like, I would be coming home from work off the L. I'd be walking down Cambria Street, and he'd be walking up, and, like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm going to get a grilled chicken sandwich. You ain't getting a grilled chicken sandwich nowhere in Kensington and Bodega. I'm sorry, chicken cheesesteak, sure. You're not getting a grilled chicken. And he always had a Miami Dolphins hat on when he was going to cop. I'm like, you sure? He's like, yeah. Nick couldn't stay sober to save his life. He was a union, I don't know if he was a carpenter or laborer. He worked for Axis Construction, which is a pretty big outfit. I had a good job. He made a ton of money, worked a ton of overtime. His kid was in his life. He had tons of money in the bank. Like, I knew it to be a fact. Like, we became pretty close. And Nick couldn't get a day. Because Nick did everything but this. You know, Nick did everything but listen. Nick did everything but the leveling of pride and the soul searching, all that great stuff that the steps just happened to ram in your ass. Like, he missed all that because he knew what he had to do. And when it came time for Nick to do an inventory, he said, "I'm gonna take it to my father." Because he missed it. There's something magical about me wanting to share who I really am with a human being that I really don't even know. That's my experience. And Nick couldn't get a day. We were outside of Sadie's big book study, and he was crying like a baby. Grown man, he's Italian. Like, they're not crying people to my experience. Most men aren't crying, especially not Italian men. And he's crying like a baby. And I said, "What can I do? Like, is there anything I can do?" And I don't say stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm plotting on the money that's in his sock drawer if I know he's going to be here crying for the next half hour. Like, I can get back across Lehigh Avenue in about 7 minutes. Like, you know what I mean? Taking his money. And I said, "What can I do?" And he said, "Can you make time for me? Can you hang out with me? Can you open this book up with me? Can you do that for me?" And I said, "Yeah." And that's what I did. And I didn't take him through the steps, but I opened the book and I kind of I read, and I can, at this point, my mind's kind of quieted a little bit. So I can read something and comprehend it and reflect it back to you, what I think or my experience. And that's kind of what we did. And I don't think Nick was ever sober when we did it, but it didn't matter. You know what I mean? And one day we're walking out of his house and I'm going to walk down Frankfurt Avenue. I remember it was yesterday. I could tell you where I was at. I could tell you what he was wearing, what I was wearing. And we shook hands. He was, nice guy. So I walk into the corner, we wait for the bus, whatever, and we're talking. And, he said, "I feel strong when I'm around you." And I'm like, people are like, "Man, Chuck, every time I come out, by the end of the night, I'm doing something I don't want to do, you know what I mean? Or, yeah, you can get a drink of water, but stay here. We'll bring it out to you. Or, you ain't coming to my house." And, just get in and out. And no. It was the only thing I ever heard. Like, just get lost. Stay away from my daughter. Stay away from my kids. You're fired. You know what I mean? And they don't say, positive affirmations to me, I felt something when he said that. And I can't explain what I felt unless you felt it. But it was like a fire. It was right here. And a smile came directly after it. I've started to really experience what this program claims to offer, and it's not even a claim because I know it to be a fact. And I continue to take action, and I made every mistake you could possibly make. You know what I mean? I did a lot of things I wasn't supposed to do sober. Like, I'll tell you what, you want to come in here and do nothing? I'll tell you what, I don't know about out here, but I'll tell you what, in Philadelphia and AA, you can become a better bank thief, a better car thief, a better gambler, a better drug dealer. You know what I mean? They'll tell you where all the doctors are to hustle, you know what I mean, for Percocets and Xanax and all that crap. And, they'll teach you how to prey on women. And not to say that that's all that there is to offer, but, if that's what you're going there looking for, you can get it. It's probably everywhere. And I don't know. I ran into people that were about the 12 steps, and they were about doing what was right in spite of the consequences. And I didn't listen. I was 20-some years old, man. You know what I mean? I wanted women and, jobs and all that crap. And, I never veered away from the 12 steps and the actions that are suggested. I spent a whole summer with this crazy individual. If I name his name, I'm sure somebody here will know, but it's irrelevant. We spent the whole summer in this Ford Taurus driving people from Kensington to Horsham Clinic, from Horsham Clinic to Norristown State Hospital. We took half of the Badlands to detox. And he used to joke, and he used to call MDU, it was Mobile Detox Unit. There's probably somebody in this room that Mikey Wu drove the detox in a blue Ford Taurus. You know what I mean? I will almost guarantee it. And that's what we did. And I continued to do the 12 steps. That's about all he did. And it was nice. And it was a good experience, and I wouldn't give it back for the world. I don't know if I helped all those people, you know what I mean? But I knew I was able to plant a lot of seeds, and it felt good. And I don't know. I met a girl. I had a child in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's one of us. And in 2008, I probably had to make the most heart-wrenching decision I ever made in my life. I walked into the family court of Philadelphia and filed an emergency petition to take custody of my child from his mother. And it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. And sober was nothing. You know what I mean? Jail, nothing. I cried like a baby in this courtroom, not sure if the decision I made was going to negative or positively affect, this year-old child or not. But I knew, he couldn't be in the care of a drug addict. And it flipped my life upside down. And I'll tell you what, I dealt with it for a long time. She drank, she came, she went, she came, she went. And you know, somebody said to me one day, like, why do you keep dealing with this? Like, is it about convenience? And for a long time it was, like, and I made that decision, and I took custody of my child, and I just dropped him off a couple hours ago. My best friend lives around the corner, girl I grew up with. You know, he'll hang out there, I'll come back. So if I storm out of here, don't get all disrespected if I'm, you know what I mean? Like, I gotta go pick my kid up. You know what I mean? I don't have a half hour to do the thank you line. And, but I took custody of this child, and, you know, like, it started off as nothing. Like, I left her when she was pregnant. She was, you know, I don't know, she's doing stuff that people that come to AA do. You know what I mean? And, I was like, yeah, so you're pregnant. I'm not sure if it's mine. You got a heroin habit. Like, nah. You know, and the child was born, and, you know, like, there was another guy in the picture already who was convinced it was it, even though the kid came out blue eyes and a big head like this. I mean, it was, you know what I mean? Like, people were like, you sure you didn't give birth to him? Like, yeah, I'm sure I did. And, you know, and so here I am, with these people. This, they're like, they have a family, you know what I mean? They, you know, and they're not letting go of this kid. This is theirs as far as they're concerned, and, and I ate shit for a long time. Like, this kid never, you know, saw me beat his mother up, never saw me drunk, never had to come visit me in a prison. And, you know, but they held the ball. And, you know, I started off an hour on Mondays. I was allowed to go. And this other guy from AA opened his apartment. I'll be living in the apartment beneath him. He didn't know me from a can of paint. But his day off was Monday. He opened up his apartment so I could spend time with my son in his living room. And, you know, the unselfishness of these men as we've come to know them, or how's it worded at the end of the doctor's opinion, like, this is what they were talking about. And, I don't even know normal church-going folks that would have did that for a stranger. But this guy did it, and I owe my life to him, and it started off as that, and then I started to show up with my mother for a few hours, and then I started to take him for a few hours, and before I know it, she was pregnant again with, you know, other children with this guy, and, she was what's known as, like, preterm labor, I believe the term is, or the proper terminology. And one of the, you know, limitations, she couldn't lift anything, like, more than 30 pounds. I think my son came out, he was, like, 28 pounds, you know what I mean? Fucking huge. And so she's like, you know, I need help. And up to this point, everybody that ever tried to help her, she took advantage of. There was no help left. Like, I was the only one. The boyfriend works a job in a restaurant, like, 80 hours a week. He's never home. And, you know, when I showed up, and, it was kind of crazy. Like, I'm over there, I'm learning how to be a father, change diapers and all this stuff, and she's getting high here and there, but I'm not too sure, and I really don't know what to do, because they're just letting me in the door, and, you know, and I learned how to care for a child. Like, it's not like, some dude was like, it's like taking care of a puppy. I said, no. Let me tell you something. If anybody tells you that, get away from them, okay? It ain't nothing like taking care of a puppy. And, you know, before I know, like, the tables turn, I'm taking him for the weekend. I was going to school part-time. I would come the 2 days I went to school during the week, come get him at their school. We'd ride all over the city doing God knows what, And you know, came one day where it just, you know, her alcoholism got out of control, and I had to take my son, and, man, it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life, and, I sat in this, like, Mexican place after the hearing. You gotta leave, they do the paperwork, you come back, they stamp it, seal it, and you go on your way, and, I was crying, and it's, like, eerie, because I didn't know if I made the right decision, you know, like, now today I do, and, like, I'm mom and dad today, and, I don't just, like, peel off $50 and take him to the park on Sunday, you know what I mean? Like, 24/7. If he wakes up at 3 in the morning, like, last night, I'm coming here, he's laughing. I'm like, you know what I mean? And, you know, like, and that's what I deal with, and, you know, like, without the help of my family, I don't know if I could have did it without the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I'd love to act like some spiritual guru, but I just, like, had a gang war via text message with my son's mother, you know, a half hour ago, calling her every piece of shit in the book. Like, I'm far from a perfect human being. And then I'm right on the phone driving down 309 with my boy. I'm like, all right, so I sounded, you know, so-and-so. He's like, yeah. He said, well, dude, you probably told her the truth. The problem is it's not your place. And he said, yeah, you probably got to make that right. And I'm like, you know what I mean? And I don't know, like, it's like trial and error, and, you know, I you know, full battles in court and all this stuff, like, and I don't know where the strength comes from, because I've dealt with hell, you know what I mean? Hell, absolute hell, and, you know, like, there was nothing like dropping my child off and not being sure whether he was safe or not, and, I don't know, like, these are the experiences. Like, I showed up in the beginning, and, I mean, paternity testing. We did the Maury Povich drawing. Like, he's still named after her boyfriend because by the time I got the power to rename my son, he was like 14 months old. Everybody's like, it's a little late, dude. Like, I mean, is it realistic? Sure, but now. You know, and like, and none of it matters. And I don't care what his name is. His name could be Sasquatch. I love him the same. And, you know, and like, I did like the whole, like, you know, the kid's yours, the kid's not, the phone call with the test, they call you with the results, and all was nuts. And I can remember my buddy, like a guy that was with me, this dude's nuts. Helped me every step of the way through this. Another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's insane. He's one of the sickest dudes I know. Okay? But there's no qualifications in God's world on who can and can't do this. Okay? He didn't take me through steps, but every single day when I called him and said, I went to work and took her flowers and she's not there. You gotta come get me. He was every step of the way. You know, when I went to that same work with a knife in my pocket, I said, I'm gonna stab everybody in here until I find out who gave her a drink. He was there. And when I kicked her out, he was there. When she came back, he was there. When I kicked her out again, he was there again. And I mean, there. Like, I lived between Richmond and Clearfield, or between Clearfield and Allegheny on Richmond Street. They were in the Sunoco in the parking lot waiting for her to leave. Like, that's what AA did for me. And it's not the answer, you know, because at the end of all this, like, fellowshipping, when I go home at 2 a.m., I'm ready to kill her and me again. You know what I mean? And my experience was one day, it was too much. Like, you know that anxiety, that pain where you're... And you don't know what the next move is. And you can't sit still, and you can't think straight, and your heart's ready to explode. And there's only one thing left to do for a guy like me, and that's get on my knees and say, God, you gotta fucking help me. Yeah, just like that. You gotta help me, man. I can't do this. And that's, you know, what works for me. And this guy stood by me through the whole thing. And we drove up to Roxborough to take this DNA test, and I remember. I was like, I had always had a good job. I lived in like a small one-bedroom apartment in Port Richmond, and I had money. And I treat us to Dunkin' Donuts, and we get sausage, egg, and cheese on a bagel and coffees. And he said, I'll let you enjoy it. I'll let you treat. He said, you better enjoy it, motherfucker, because it's going to be the last one you ever purchase as a single man. And you know what I mean? We go and we take this paternity test, and you know, I don't need to take a paternity test. The dude on the phone, and he's like, why don't you just give me 20 and I'll save you the aggravation? Like, cause there's no question whose child it is, but you know, and I played by the rules. I did everything by the rules. The PennDOT deed that I'm not allowed to have a driver's license in like 2000 because I done drove under the influence of every benzo and opiate under the book and stole cars and got DUIs and all this stuff, and I'm 4 years sober and I go through the motions of all the CRN evaluations and all the DUI. See, everybody done state driving school on Saturdays here? Oh my God. Let me tell you something. Dude, I've been stuck up at gunpoint, okay? And it was less painful than the $275 it cost to sit through these godforsaken classes for 16 hours. Horrible. Okay? Alright, I did all that. I got a driver's license. I got a truck out there. It runs pretty good. It's a 96, but it does the deal. And I just... served a year with an interlock device in my car. I hadn't had a drink in a year when I got the DUI. And so I look at the judge, I'm like, never smoke crack, man. You know what I mean? I'm not getting a DUI. Like, but whatever. Like, I played by the rules. I didn't drive until I got my license back and play roulette and all. I paid, the last county on the bill was Chester County. I just paid them $1,370 so they didn't lock my ass up. I just got the paperwork in the mail. You have successfully completed all the stipulations of your disposition and release. We hope, we hope that your experience with whatever has been rewarding. You know what I mean? Whatever. I'm like, yeah, it sure has. And I played by the rules. Court, my son's mother, I played by the rules. Like, we've been going back and forth. I gotta take him to family court at 1801 Vine every Sunday so he can visit with his mother. I hate it. I don't want to do this, but, you know, I would give her the door open. She'd show up to my house on dope. Like, yeah, I'm all right. You know what I mean? And I played by the rules. We gotta go back to court. And I did everything by the rules. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't get you can get an insurance card printed out for like $20. I didn't do none of that. You know, I didn't put it in somebody else's name and drive without a license until this went through. And you know, I rode the bus until I was allowed to get a driver's license. and I walked into the clerk of courts and peeled off 18 $100 bills, and I got the receipt that was, I could send the PennDOT, get my license back. And I paid the $300 for this interlock device, which was the worst, the most humbling experience I've ever had in my life. First of all, it's so embarrassing. Second of all, it costs so much money. Every time you breathe the wrong way, it costs $50 extra. I'm throwing it at the windshield on 76, lying to the guy, telling him my son broke it, and all this stuff. But I, you know, like, I, the best way to get this right is by fucking it up. And I'm sorry to curse. God's already forgiven me, but so I don't want to hear it afterwards. But you know, like, that's the best way to get this. And I came in here, I filed for, like, when it's available, I can make myself available. People ask me, you know, will you sponsor me? Gladly, I lend my time. I don't do this. I'm not one of these people that's like, I got to do it to get another day. Like, I do this because this spared me from a life of terror and bewilderment, frustration and anguish and turmoil and all this crap. Like, I don't got to be homeless anymore. Like, that's legit. The cops pull me over, and I'm going to talk slick to them when they pull me over because I'm legit. You know what I mean? You know why I pulled you over? Nah. You know, not yet, Mr. Officer. You know, and like, and I had like the worst summer I've ever had. My car got impounded twice by the city of Philadelphia this summer. Chester County mailed me a letter, said, you don't give us $1,300 by August 15th, we're locking your fat ass up. And there was no like, oh, but no, we want our money. And they'll lock you up and you'll still owe the money, pretty much what they told me. You know, like, by no means is it like some peaches and cream, but like everything comes together. Like, you know, like the state okayed me to get subsidized funding for daycare because I pay like $1,000 a month for child care for my son. You know what I mean? And I don't get a penny from his mother. And I take it all on the chin. And like, that's like a big thing for me. Like, I got okayed for it. Like, I met a nice girl a few, you know, months back, and like, we talk and like, we're building a relationship like non-predatory human beings should build a relationship. She's not from the program. Sorry, but I do want alcohol per household. I'm too selfish. You know what I mean? And, you know, like, I moved in when I left my apartment. I had a perfectly good apartment when I took my son. I moved in with my parents because I never raised a child before. I know how to build a house. You know what I mean? Like, I see this. I do this crap all day long. Frame, shingles, you know what I mean? Power lamps, raising kids. And, you know, and I knew I couldn't do it on my own. It was the most humbling experience I had in my life. Like, I could have afforded to stay in that apartment and wing it, you know, but, and you know, without them, I don't know if I would have made it through it. Now I'm getting ready to move into an apartment in Sanatoga. I don't know, it's like so way out of my realm, but whatever. You know, I live a pretty good life. Like, I'm going to leave here, I'm going to drive down 309, go pick my son up, and, you know, we're going to go home, and, you know, I'll probably be praying on the way home because his mom will be calling me every no-good MF-er in a book via text message like 7 minutes from now. You know what I mean? Whatever. My life's good. Like, I'm a pillar in my family. I'm a pillar to anybody that's in my life. You know, like, my word is like gold. I tell you, like, when I say something, I mean it. And I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And that's the most I got, you know what I mean? And I got a decent job. I never stole from my boss. I never dealt drugs on his job site. I never stole all the copper out of the walls after work hours. I didn't come back and rob all the line sets out of the air conditioners. You know what I mean? Because that's what I do, okay? 4 o'clock rolls around, I'm in the trailer selling coke and weed and stealing all the copper out of the house that the plumbers just put in. You know what I mean? Like, that's who I am. And I had great experiences, and I got 2 minutes. I'm using every last one of them. And, you know, everybody, I'm going to say this real quick. Everybody gets up at the podium and shares these experiences about their amends and all. And my greatest experience is, like, through other people. Like, I remember I was helping this guy, and, you know, he said, I talked about making this amends for 10 years and never did it. Since 97 when I came in here, I've been told my father was dead. And I said, write him a letter, man. You know what I mean? And we went to this cemetery on Frankfurt Avenue on a Saturday. It was raining. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I do like Air Jordans and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I don't kneel down in grass, okay? For nobody. Not even the police. You know what I mean? And here I am on a Saturday afternoon. We're on our knees. It's like drizzling. It's like wet and all. We're on our knees. We say a prayer. And, you know, he reads this letter and kind of, like, makes, you know, some kind of amends. And, And, like, they're the experiences that, like, keep me coming back. Like, watching girls, you know, come into AA and get their kids back and get jobs and get nursing degrees and cars and whatever, you know, like, all this stuff. And it's just great to watch people come in here and, like, take up their beds and walk again. And that's what the big book says is available here. Like, if you're here for the wrong reasons, welcome. Like, it's not like you got to do it for yourself. Like, dude, shut up. Stop telling people that, okay? It doesn't matter why you come here. If you show up and follow just a little bit of direction, eventually it will work. There's not a bingo wheel with numbers in it. You know what I mean? I hear the same shit that everybody else sat through and was like, why is this guy going to shut up? And, you know, somebody made it attractive one day, and I took the 12 steps, and I lived a pretty good life ever since. And I don't get up in the morning and say, please, God, don't let me drink today. It's still about a drink. You know what I mean? My sex conduct, my work conduct, my everything conduct, you know, directly relates to a drink. But I don't fight this on a day-to-day basis, and I've been everywhere. You know, everywhere, and I'll be everywhere. You know what I mean? And I don't fight the urge to drink or drug, and that's just about enough for me. And I don't, you know, it's been a long time since I've been homeless. I got told, you ain't sleeping in my car, piece of shit. Get lost. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I could go on for days about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life and what it'll do in yours. You know, and there's plenty of other people that I know firsthand that have had this experience and would love to pass it on to you. And that's all I got. Thank you.